2017 is now called to order. I would like the record to show that Deputy Mayor Susan McLeod is absent today. Under 2.0, changes, approval of agenda. I have one addition to the agenda this morning. It is 16.6, legal advice, MGA 22(2)(g). Are there any other changes or adjustments in the agenda today? A motion to approve the agenda as amended would be in order. Moved by Councilor Fisk, seconded by Councilor Fairley. Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion? Unanimous. Thank you. We will now move on to 3.0 presentations, and under presentations, we have 3.1 at the Lakers, and I would ask Myrna Gillis if she would please come forward.
Thank you, Mayor. So I'd like to introduce you to the worst kept secret in Queens County, and that's Aqualitas. I'm Myrna Gillis, CEO and founder. And we are an aquaponics cannabis company, and it's our intention to operate out of the Bowater Mercy site. We have taken possession of our building June 1st, and our good friend Trent Hubman, NHRS Construction, has started our build-out. What I'd like to do is tell you just a little bit about ourselves and why, first of all, we came to the South Shore. One of the things that was very important to us was to find, obviously, a location that we thought had the best opportunity for expansion. We had a job-ready labor market, which was very important to us, and we had a site that was the hosting two components, one a technology demonstration center, and the other is that it was a MARSEC secure site, and it offered our company an envelope of security already that was pre-existing. So we looked for a long time, and we are glad that we've made our home here. We have been welcomed with open arms by council starting in 2014, right up until now. We have been somewhat under the radar intentionally, because we didn't want to come to the community and make an announcement before we were actually doing something. So this was part of the reason that we wanted to wait. We are now in the late stages of the licensing process, and we know that Health Canada, just even as recently as May, has made changes to expedite the licensing process. Our original target date was hopefully February of 2018, but we hope to have our building ready for inspection in the fall. So we're very sort of excited to make that announcement. What I do want to tell you about with our company that's quite interesting and unique, and I think it also celebrates our Nova Scotia heritage. We have, in our process, we're using what's called aquaponics. And aquaponics is really a combination of aquaculture and horticulture. And if you think of the founding industries of the Maritimes, agriculture and fisheries was always a very significant component of that. And for us, what we do is basically we have modernized those historical industries for this province, and we are using it in our cultivation practice. So aquaponics is when you use essentially live fish in an aquaculture setting to provide the nutrients to the plants, and in this case it would be cannabis plants that we are growing. And that is a completely symbiotic process, and it's a closed loop process, which also leaves a much more improved environmental footprint than traditional cultivation practices for cannabis. Now I'll just highlight a few things here about our proprietary process. We've actually been working for years on this proprietary process, and aquaponics has been around for a while, but what people traditionally use it for is for green leafy vegetables or plants that have used significant amounts of nitrates. But it wasn't so good with flowering plants. And of course, cannabis, the most valuable part of the plant is the flower. And so we have been working with Acadia University, and now we're at Dalhousie University with the scale-up of our working prototype. But we have addressed these deficiencies for flowering. And so what the process, and just to give you some sense of it, we use 90% less water than traditional cultivation practices. We use less electricity in our process because we're also using LED lights. And we have spared sort of no expense in trying to make decisions that are good for the environment. We have also, it's an all-natural process. And if you're reading anything in the paper, one of the things that you're going to see a lot of, and there's been five companies already, that there's been issues with pesticides and whether they're getting in inadvertently or deliberately. One of the nice things about our process is that you can't cut any corners. You can't use pesticides. It would affect the health of the fish. So it's an all-natural process, and it is a pesticide-free process. The other thing with this is that because the plants always have access to their nutrients, the plants grow more quickly, and the cycles turn more quickly. So it's also a good sort of cultivation technique as well, and you get larger, healthier yields. And finally, and most importantly for the consumer, because we use the water and we recycle it again and again, and we grow in a controlled environmental agriculture environment, we have a product that is safe, consistent, and is free of these, pesticides, and is a good quality product for the consumer. So that's a little bit about our company. I'd like to tell you also just a little bit about our team. I have some members of our team here with me today. I have our VP and General Counsel, Barbara Darby, Jeff Garnham, who is head of our operations, Jake Ward, who's with cultivation. We consider Trent, even though he's a contractor, Trent is an integral part of our team. Trent Huffman is here from HRS. And just to give you a little perspective, I want to sort of give a bit of a shout out to Trent as well, is that we had the pleasure of going to the Bowater sites last week and just speaking to the crew that was working there. And for some of them, it was their first time returning to Bowater since its closure. And they were very excited about the prospect of a new industry and the sense of renewal. When I left there, I was quite inspired and very moved. And so we're very proud to work with Trent. But Trent also has been very practical, very helpful. He's a troubleshooter. If Trent is any indication of the gems that are in this community from a workforce perspective, we are very lucky. We also know that Jeff and Jake are also from the South Shore, so we already have people that are working in positions. One of the questions we always get, and also we have Jaina here from is our co-op student. We have three co-op students working with us this summer, one in our office in Bedford, one at Dalhousie, and one at Acadia. Doing some research. So the final thing I suspect that people want to know about is jobs. That is a question that we often get. So to give you some perspective of sort of the trajectory of our project, we are currently doing our build out of 70,000 square feet of production space. Every 4,000 square feet of production space is a full-time position. So we are starting, we will be starting with approximately 15 cultivation positions that will grow upward. But there are, and in the cultivation employment, that would include things such as trimming, processing, harvesting, cultivation. We have fish positions because someone has to be there to take care of the fish health. We have quality assurance people, one of whom is also from the South Shore, one of our quality assurance individuals. We have marketing positions, sales positions, reception positions, office positions, security positions. So there's a wide sort of gamut of opportunity. And we also have a first option on 24 acres in the park for the potential for expansion. And certainly if we believe our product is going to resonate with individuals, and you know, we got into this business for medical cannabis. The legalization wasn't even on the horizon when we entered this industry, and that is still where our passion lies, and we would like to be leaders in research, and we would like to be at the forefront of that type of work in the industry. And obviously the other market may come along in July, but we want to assure you that our business model is based on the medical market, and that's the market that is here, and that's the market that we know of, and that is a viable business model for us as it stands, with only the opportunity to expand, obviously, if the industry expands. And it will, and Canada is also seen as a leader in this industry at this time, and it's very exciting to be part of this for us. I also want to just give a nod to Nova Scotia Lands and Harborside Industrial Park as well. They have been very welcoming to us in transitioning to the park, and we're working closely to make sure that our project is a success. And finally, I also want to give a nod to InnovaCorps. InnovaCorps has been, in particular Paul Richards, has been integral in giving us mentorship and directing our project, particularly as relates to our innovative technology and our research and development. So a little plug as well, if you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, one of the things that we will have is we'll be posting updates. And for people to know when the time comes for us to be accepting applications, we will work with the municipality in doing a job fair so that there's an opportunity. And that wouldn't be before the fall. So as much as the enthusiasm is there, I just want to give you some sense of a timeline. But we will work with the municipality. We will make sure that the message gets out. And we are very proud to be here. And the Green Blue Renew, just to give you a quick snapshot on that as well, is green is for our environmental practices and the plant that we grow. Blue is for our nutrient-rich water, which is part of our proprietary process. And renewal is finding balance. And that's balance in life for your health and wellness, but it's also balance in our system and our process, because aquaponics, that's how it works, is through balance. And so we're very proud to be here. And one final thing about Aqualitas, and how do you pronounce the name, or what is the name? The name comes from sort of it's an amalgam of a couple of things. The first is water and quality, so Aqualitas, but also it means shoreline. And so it's where the land and water meet. And we are, of course, located on the shoreline of the beautiful South Shore, and the Maritimes essentially is a shoreline, the Nova Scotia as a peninsula. So we think it's a fitting name for our company, both from a position of origin, but also combining the ideas of water and quality together as well. So that's a little bit about us. I know we've got some time set aside for any media inquiries as well, but I don't know if council has any questions or anything, but we're...
Thank you, Myrna. At this time, we usually allow councillors to ask a few questions or make comments,
sure.
So I will ask councillors if there are any. Anyone like to go first? Councillor Fancy.
Yes. Great presentation again.
Thank you.
Again, as you said, it's a secret that hasn't been very secret. But when I look at here, two questions I ask is that long term, you're here for the long run.
Yes.
And that's what we're here. So if somebody's, especially if people are applying, jobs are a number one priority. And the other thing, you say you're starting off with 15. This could grow into a lot bigger operation, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we already, by the end of June, we'll have 8 people on the payroll already. So that, and if you add, say, one for every 4,000 square feet of cultivation, we have 70,000 feet that are being built out right now. So that alone in cultivation positions would be 15, in the near future. But we think that in the building, we're looking at roughly 60 positions. And if we go past the footprint of the building, which is certainly our goal, then we've had individuals that have put the numbers sort of south of 100 for that, and potentially more. But I think I think it's safe to say 60. I think that's a realistic short term number. And as the industry grows, so will we. And we want to make. And then the other thing that's important, just to let you know, in the sense of the long-term nature of it, is that our aquaculture license is for 10 years, and we have, we want to make permanent roots in the park, and that's certainly our goal. As long as Nova Scotia Lands continues to work with us in that direction, we'll be well set.
Thank you. Councillor Fisk?
First of all, did you bring samples?
No samples. Not growing yet. No license. So, yeah.
Interesting. 60 full-time employees?
Yes, that would be a combination. That's 60 FTE, so that
out
could
of
be
that
multiple
60,
part-time
how many,
positions.
How many local people being?
Well, our expectation is that most of the positions would be local, because we're looking at, there's a lot of transferable skills. So let's just take anybody that ever worked in fish processing could be a trimmer, probably. Good transferable skills there. We are going to look for people that have some horticulture and some fishing background or work with fish. I mean, there are people, there's aquaculture that was here, so presumably there are some people with experience with that. There's just some physical plant issues as well, that people that are familiar with steam. Steam experts are all local, that you're going to find that more locally than you will somewhere else. So, I mean, our expectation is at least, you know, more than the majority of positions should be local positions.
Very good presentation.
Any other councillors? Councillor Kelly?
Hi, thank you. And it's been a wonderful presentation. I would love to listen to you talk because you're very passionate about what you do, and you've been doing it for a long time, and you know exactly what you're doing. My question is around the, you say you're growing medical marijuana.
Yes.
But how do you see that happening if marijuana is now legalized, or will be in 2018, July? How is that going to affect the medical side of it, and is medical different from what will be actually legalized in the that will be out there?
No, it's a good question. So I think that one of the things that would distinguish medical cannabis, the plants are all the same, you know, in the sense of the strains. You may have someone that can find medical benefit from a strain that someone else is using recreationally. It's the sort of the combination of the THC and the CBD and the other cannabinoids that are in the plant. But for a patient, there are some things that might distinguish it from the rec market. So, for example, some people would irradiate a medical product. So if you had a bad immune system, you might have an extra process that the product would go through because of those sensitivities. If you want medical, you probably might have chemical sensitivities and don't want something that's grown hydroponically. You want something that's organic or something that's all natural. I think that the rec consumer probably values all natural as well, but those are some of the things. Also, from a price point of view, there's a lot of pressure and advocacy going on right now to make medical cannabis exempt of HST. Medical cannabis is also deductible. And the other thing that probably is the most significant difference is that a lot of people who purchase medical cannabis use oils, and they use high CBD oils. And CBD, and this is, you know, sort of part of the beginning of an education about cannabis, CBD has a no euphoric effect. So if someone is looking for sort of relaxation or some type of euphoria, they're not going to get that with a lot of the medical strains of cannabis because they're high CBD, or could be, or even balances of CBD. So those are some of the things. But that's not to say that, you know, someone who buys a strain may very well have crossover into the other component. But and also the delivery mechanism might be different. You know, you might take medical with a cartridge or with a tablet, a pill, a pre-dosed form, which is a little bit different. Most of it's in the delivery mechanism.
Are you going to be supplying all markets?
Our intention is to supply all markets. I think that what we want to do is, I mean, our first step is to literally dip our toe into the demand, you know, and to understand what is the demand for our product and what do people want, and where does that bring us. But we are carrying CBD strains. We are not, there are companies that are all THC. We will have CBD strains, and that's a very important part for us. We also have a medical patient advisory board that consists of doctors, healthcare workers, and also patients that use medical cannabis. And they are really shaping our company in the sense of products that we're going to offer and what we'll make available. And one of the things that was very important to them was that we have a significant amount of CBD strains, dominant strains in our mix.
Right. Just one more question about the licensing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought that before you actually set up and made your announcement, you were waiting for a federal license, and now you still not have a license?
No, we wanted to wait until we hit the a stage in the licensing process where we were through what are some of the toughest hurdles. And so when we were here before, we had not passed through the security component, and we're now in sort of the review stage. Also, Health Canada on May 26th, changed the game altogether, and where there used to be 7 steps before, now there are 6 steps, and licensing is issued. They'll give you a cultivation license even before an inspection. So we expedited our process to meet the changes of the regulator and to see where we were at with the process. But we don't have our license, and I want to make that perfectly clear. But we want to now get the facility ready. ready so that when the time comes, we hit the ground running with what we're doing.
Is there an expectation date on when you get that license?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because, for example, yesterday 3 licenses were issued. That's the first time since April 2014 there were 3 licenses issued in one day. So I think if you can expect that the process, you know, if before that, I would have said February, but now it could potentially be earlier, it could be later. I mean, the biggest uncertainty in this process is the regulator. We're not sure, you know, we're on their timeline, and we do what we can to advance the project to make sure we're ready for their questions. We've responded to them very quickly every time that they have had questions for us, and every time we've engaged with them, we've moved very quickly to the next stage.
Thank you very much. Thanks for choosing Queens County.
Thank you for having us.
Councillor Bill.
Nice to see you back again. Such great news. Just a question about the process. It was very interesting to me. Are there other similar ones in Canada, North America, and where would be the closest?
Yeah, so there's one other company that grows aquaponically, and they're outside of Hamilton, and they're called Green Relief, and they use a turnkey system. Our system is proprietary, and it's unique to us. There's no one else that is using the exact combination of what we've put together, and I credit Jeff and, you know, Trent and Jake for that, and Jeff has really taken the lead with the operations of that system, and it's been tremendous, you know, and I think that the other piece about our proprietary process is that we believe that it will have application for food security as well. This is not just something that's for cannabis. I mean, this can have real impact, particularly when you look at things like water shortages. You look at some of the biggest areas in North America that have droughts now, you know, for cultivation, which used to be the, you know, sort of the leaders of the food supply chain. So we think that at the end of the day, that technology is the real game changer. Cannabis is the engine and the capital that drives the innovation, but the innovation is the real story here.
Great, thank you.
Any other councillors? Councillor Fancy?
The other question I have to ask is more on the medical side.
Sure.
Of with the medical providers, that has always been a problem because they won't provide for things. So you're not, where are you with, say, like the Nova Scotia formulary, that you can be able to get into spots where then the medical providers will then in turn be able to accept it?
Sure. So actually, Nova Scotia has the highest prescription rate of any province in the country for adoption by physicians of medical cannabis. So we actually have a medical community that understands the benefits of medical cannabis. I think that the chief issue that some physicians have is the idea of the consistency, the strain, and the dosing, because it's not something that they're familiar with. I mean, most often a pharmaceutical company will come in and they will say, our product is X, it does Y, these are the, whereas with medical cannabis, it's a very sort of unique interaction with someone's body, not any differently than any other drugs, but that is sort of part of the sort of the learning curve is to understand that. But one of the real things, so it is changing. First, number one, Nova Scotia has the high, if not the highest, among the highest prescription by doctors. The second is a real game changer occurred when there was an undisputed sort of discovery that our body is made up of the cannabinoid system. And we have receptors in our brain and along our spinal cord, which if you think of a lock and a key, that's what medical cannabis is full of cannabinoids. And it actually corresponds perfectly with the CB1 and the CB2 receptors in our bodies. And so because of that, that's where doctors started to say, okay, there's some correlation here between what's happening in nature and what's happening in people's bodies. And bringing those two things together were important. The third thing is that the prescription rates and medical cannabis is growing 30% per quarter. So you can see astronomically that those numbers, we are already ahead. Health Canada projected 450,000 medical patients by 2024. We're halfway there already in 2017. So the projections for medical are about 715,000. So those things are being overcome, and they're overcome by patients basically going and saying, I've tried this, it works, and doctors saying, and the other factor is the opiate crisis. People, the medical profession is screaming for an alternative to pain relief for chronic conditions, and cannabis is a natural fit, and I mean that literally and figuratively for that. And so and it's also, you know, seen as a potential aid in that, you know, sort of in that fight. So I think that the ground is swelling, you know, towards the recognition, and literally every single day there is a new study out. I read one this morning on Alzheimer's. You know, so it's every day that you know the evidence just gets more and you know more documented, and you have to remember research was quashed because it was a Schedule I drug for the last 70 years. You know, that more than 70 years, almost, you know, so since 1937. So that's the, you know, those are the variables. But no, there's a real change. And then the final thing is in there's cannabinoid clinics. There's medical clinics that are doctors' clinics that specialize in cannabis. And so if a family physician isn't comfortable just because they're not familiar with it, they're referring their patients to those clinics and then coming back, and then they're following their care and getting the comfort level and prescribing. But there's lots of doctors in Nova Scotia that that do prescribe.
Councillor Kelly.
Just one more question. Is your company taking any kind of advocacy role with the Nova Scotia government regarding the legislation? Is there anything there that specifically would affect your company based on legislation?
As far as the retail model, we have not done any direct advocacy with any stakeholder. We're not registered lobbyists. We're not, you know, that's not. But if you're asking, I'm more than happy to share a view on that. I think for us, one of the things that we think is imperative under the provincial model and that should continue indefinitely is that is the mail order system. We have a province where, you know, rural areas that there may not be access or a, you know, a retail outlet in a community. So for us to have the ability to interact with our clients, particularly our medical clients, but anyone, you know, wishing to access cannabis, that the mail order, you know, system stay in place. There are three other models that are generally bantered about as where things will go. One is the NSLC or an Atlantic unified model between all of the Atlantic provinces. Regarding age and regarding the distribution stream. One of the things that's nice about the NSLC model, I think, just is that there's already existing infrastructure in place. You know, there are checks and balances for age and things like that to check. And this is all on the recreational side.
Yeah.
But one of the nice things is that what people may not realize is that, and we've done our research, is that $650 million were the sales in alcohol last year, and a third of that, or almost $220 million of that, was local producers. And so one of the strategic initiatives of that model, of that branding for the province, is they have five, and one, the number one, is local producers. Number four is environmental sustainability. And, you know, we do both of those things really well. You know, we don't play lip service to it. We built our company around those things. And so if that model, if it was a buy local model and they applied the same principles to medical cannabis, that would be certainly, I think, a good thing for us. Deloitte & Touche says that it's going to be 40% of the alcohol, so 70% of Canadians consume alcoholic beverages, and they anticipate it will be 40% for cannabis. So just do the numbers and do the math. I mean, that's a fairly significant industry just in the buy local market. But our expanse is obviously domestically across Canada, but we're also looking at international export as well. Because we think that for the companies, the countries that do medical and receive medical exports, we have a really clean way of growing it, and we think it would be an excellent platform for research in other countries as well.
Great, thank you.
Any other councillors? Thank you, Myrna. It's very good news today. Thank you for your presentation.
And
bringing your colleagues along today, members
thank
of
you.
Your team. I would like to thank Tim Crow at Nova Scotia Lands for his support through the
process.
I
see in the corner there, Tim. Yeah,
it is very good news today for Aquilitis, for Nova Scotia Lands, for Queens, and the jobs and economic development that you're bringing to the area is very appreciated.
Thank you, and if we can at some point get a picture with
yes, and my understanding is that you would like to have a picture of your team here today.
Yes.
And we can do that, and after that you're entertaining interviews with the media.
Yes.
Afterwards.
Yes.
Thank you. So perhaps we can look after the picture.
Sure. So, I think Jana will take the bird if you want to come up. Yeah.
Okay.
this morning. We are now moving on to 3.2, Medway Community Forest Co-op. We're pleased to have Mary Jane Roger here this morning, who's going to give us a presentation on the cooperative effort. Thank you.
Thanks, Mary Desley. For those of you who I haven't met before, there are quite a few familiar faces in the room. I'm here to give an update on what is the final year of the pilot project, the pilot phase with the Medway Community Forest, kind of our happenings in the past 3 years, and where our vision is going forward. I'm not going to give a very detailed introduction to the community forest, and hopefully in anticipation that most of you are already familiar with our initiative, but I will be going over those details of the past 3 years. To begin, hopefully everyone can see this. I'm going to start with a summary of our forest operations to date, and as well as some silvicultural work that we've been up to, some of the highlights in terms of public outreach over the past 3 years, as well as moving forward and looking at what is our 2017 strategic plan and going into the future of hopefully signing a long-term agreement with the Nova Scotia Department of Natural Resources. So to date, we've harvested roughly 8,500 tons of wood in a variety of product categories. So our land base is entirely located in Annapolis County, actually. Our office is in North Queens at the North Queens Business and Innovation Hub. Our original harvest operations were tendered out through an open market system, so Northern Pulp won that tender. Not all of the wood went to the pulp mill, but it was distributed through a variety of local mills. So we harvested about a total of 80 hectares using a variety of different silvicultural treatments. As well, we had to make a significant amendment to the original tender that was awarded to Northern Pulp due to the Seven Mile Lake fire last summer. So that fire was nearly entirely on our land base and was a bit of a hit for us, both economically as well as, you know, gave me a lot of extra work last summer, but has since kind of opened a lot of interesting doors in terms of new research opportunities. So with that fire, we actually also petitioned Westport Management Inc. to do some harvesting or salvaging along where the fire perimeter was cut. Silviculture work to date, we've, in conjunction with the Nova Scotia Department of Natural Resources, we've done pre-commercial thinning on roughly 300 hectares of our land base, both in 2015 and 2016, as well as done some tree planting of mainly black and red spruce. So we're actually looking to go into a more restoration standpoint from here on and experimenting with more species in our tree planting. So these substitute blocks for Northern Pulp are our most recently completed harvest areas. As you can see on the map here, this red area is the perimeter of the Seven Mile Lake fire. And it started roughly about this point here. So I had actually spent a significant amount of money building a road back there, and then someone used this road to light a fire. And so it was arson. They haven't actually found who was the culprit, but I was able to find these substitute areas for Northern Pulp, and they were able to complete our tender. So this was advantageous to us in that we were able to get the volumes, but you know, obviously there's very little market for wood that's burnt, so we've still been able to work around the area, but did suffer a loss from that. These are our blocks kind of looking into early spring 2017. We run a pretty active firewood business. We sell wood to Conway Workshop in Digby County, as well as we supply all of the firewood for Kedgy Park. So these are two really great projects that employ local people, as well as, you know, have a great local source for our wood. We make most of our revenues in selling firewood, and it's been a really, really great business for the community forest in these early years. It's also, in doing these kind of more hardwood style management, we're able to integrate partial harvest, selection harvest, these type of forest management procedures that are really integral to doing ecosystem management, which is a primary principle of the community forest. So we do some clear cutting within the community forest. There's certain stands that really best fit a clear cutting approach. So this is what a clear cut looks like in the community forest. So it's really not your traditional take everything and run away type operation. We leave a lot of trees for seed cover, roughly around 40 a hectare, and you know, promote this kind of natural, more open canopy, which would be from a fire disturbance historically. So we're experimenting with different things and measuring how regen comes up, what quality of species, different things like that, to see what's the best fit for our forest. We're also experimenting with patch removals. You can't really see much from these photos. This was taken on our northern pulp operations 2 winters ago, and this was on one of our field tours. But to provide you a more detailed diagram, we're trying to achieve what's called uneven age management. So promoting a diversity of age classes within the forest and while promoting ecosystem function and wildlife habitat. So it's basically a series of removals over a 40 to 50 year period, going in and taking kind of roughly 1/3 of the forest cover each time, and you know, still having some management for what we call more shade tolerant species. So our red oak, our white pine, our most valuable forest species that we really want to be growing. Some outreach highlights from 2016. To go through a few of them, this was done, we hosted an Envirothon silviculture workshop, so they're actually doing the water course portion of it at that point, but that was a lot of fun, as well as we hosted in conjunction with DNR and MTRI, Women in Forestry Field Day, where we took a bunch of NSCC students from the Lunenburg campus, as well as some other interested participants, out to an active harvest, and they actually got to sit in the machinery. Nobody cut any trees down, but it was a fun event where we were able to, you know, promote more gender equality in forest operations. Obviously, our firewood business has been a great success. Also, we've promoted our membership to come out to our field sites to see our forest operations. So we had about 25 people come out to our field day last year, and we hope to host another field day maybe while we have an active harvest going on this fall. We also joined up with MTRI in camp to do a kind of more detailed old growth forest inventory within the community forest, and found this beautiful red oak was one of the highlights. It was 186 years old, which isn't that old for a tree, but for a red oak, it's pretty incredible, as well as some really, really nice upwards to 300-year-old hemlock within the community forest. We also hosted a snowshoe hike with County of Annapolis, as well as a research fire tour. We're planning another fire tour this summer, more for the local Queens community. I know there a lot of people in North Queens felt the fire quite significantly, and that we want to kind of show the public what exactly happened. So I'm going to kind of delve into more of the boring part, but it's actually something that interests me a lot because it gives me a lot of gusto in moving forward with the job, is our strategic plan. So I've kind of, there are key areas that DNR evaluates the community forest on at the end of our pilot project agreement. I'll just kind of go over each of these main key areas and talk to you a bit about what we're going to be doing moving forward. So to start off, business planning, our main goal is to determine our long-term financial feasibility. So when we originally signed the pilot project agreement, we did get a significant portion of funding from DNR, which we've since all repaid back in stumpage fees, but you know, that was kind of part of the agreement. So we want to continue to, you know, keep some money in the bank, yet have a positive revenue generating, or at least be able to cover in expenses, and perhaps in the future actually generate revenue for the local community. So we're looking into different options, such as establishing a not-for-profit stream, establishing a charity stream, you know, holding more of a land trust role if woodlot owners want to retire but don't necessarily have, you know, the next generation to take over their forest management. We could maybe step in there, as well as looking into how can we have, you know, a community investment fund where you know, Caledonia is really, really seeing the benefit of having a community forest. Part of this business planning is going to be done in conjunction with a company called Common Good Solutions. They're based out of Halifax, but have a South Shore chapter. I think she's more in the St. Margaret's Bay area, but They're really act as what's called an incubator for, you know, new social enterprise businesses. So what we're trying to do is achieve, you know, a mission of a social enterprise. So going beyond local employment, having a real community benefit. So with that, we're actually looking into a project surrounding value-added wood products and how we can benefit both private woodlot owners in improving forest markets, as well as, you know, getting a bit of revenue for the local community from our land base. So generally, a lot of our membership is actually in the South Shore region. It's not inland. So we're hoping to promote more active members within the Caledonia area. So one easy way to do this is we're hoping to build signage along Highway 8 so people actually know where the community forest stops and starts, because it's not continuous, but a lot of people don't even know where we're located. As well, we're hoping to get more out into markets, getting to the local farmers markets, so sharing our mission and maybe selling some firewood along the way. So private land services has been a component of our business strategy from the get-go, but it hasn't really been something we've been able to tap into since we've been spending a lot of energy just getting our crown forest operations off the ground. So I recently developed kind of a private land cooperative is the Western Woodlot Services Cooperative, and I've been a member of the interim board for some time, as well as the advisory committee and getting it off the ground. So we're hoping to become a service provider for this woodlot co-op. So either we would hire, you know, some more technical staff, or myself would go out and, you know, advise woodlot owners on some management practices and hopefully see some benefit from aggregating wood supply and selling it from woodlot clusters throughout the 7 western counties. So it's an interesting concept. It's a huge project to handle, but we're hoping to see this succeed in the next year. We're also very interested in pursuing carbon sequestration projects. So I don't know how familiar you all are with the whole idea of sequestering carbon within forest landscapes, but it's actually a huge potential revenue stream for private woodlot owners. It doesn't mean you don't have to touch your forest at all. You have to actually continue to do improved forest management and grow the quality of your growing stock within your woodlot, which is a great way to reflect our kind of selection partial harvesting techniques for private woodlot owners. So we're working with a couple partners to do that as well. Recreation multi-use planning. So we are known as a multi-value forest manager, so we want to really delve into how to integrate different user groups within the community forest. Most of the people I encountered within the land base know it's old Bowater lands, but they don't really know a whole lot about what we're doing. So hopefully building an asset map will be something that we can get to within the next couple of years, and giving that out to individual user groups, whether it be mountain bikers, ATVers, and sharing the resource that we have within this land base, as well as maybe prevent a couple people from getting lost along the way. We're also developing a partnership with the newly designated Medway Lakes Protected Area, and specifically a footpath right off Highway 8 within the protected area. It's very conveniently located. It's known as Lewis Dump, not the best name, but it's a really, really lovely area, beautiful, like large glacial rocks, as well as some really nice old hemlock forest. So look forward to that kind of towards the end of the summer. Forest operations, we evidently want to continue to harvest wood. We're a working land base, that's our primary objective. But we're also looking at doing different research trials with the Nova Scotia Department of Natural Resources and kind of testing out ways where they can integrate less clear cutting and more partial harvesting in what sites usually come out as these seed tree or clear cut removals. We want to see if there's any ability there to manage on a lower removal stage, so it looks a whole lot better for the public and is likely much better for the forest in the long term. We're also looking to expand our firewood business. It's as I said before, a really great revenue stream for us, and provides the most significant local employment out of all of the businesses we've done today. So we did come out with a pretty large management plan. It's actually accessible through our website. We're kind of in the middle of negotiations with DNR and getting that management plan up in place, but this was one of the caveats of our agreement, was that we would have our own system to manage the land base following the pilot project agreement. So there are some sticking points that DNR, you know, has given us some feedback on that are, you know, we are a different land manager than a traditional licensee is. You know, we're not a West Fork, we're looking to do things more for the community, more for multi-value management, and more for the environment. So it's a new type of forest management that's going to take a bit of negotiations, but hopefully following these negotiations and the approval of the management plan, we'll come out with at minimum a 10-year agreement with Department of Natural Resources. We're actually hoping for a 20-year agreement, but we'll see what we can get at this point. We also want to reassess the stumpage rate system for community-based crown forest managers. Stumpage is extremely high on crown land, contrary to what you might hear from some media, but it really erodes our profit margins and makes it very difficult for us to make much money off the actual forest operations that we're doing. That's why firewood has such a higher value to us, because when you're adding more value in your production chain, you have the ability to have a higher profit margin. So working in some sort of structure where we could actually have a considerable amount of stumpage that would traditionally just go back into the government pot, actually go directly into the Caledonia community. Research. We're continually trying to pursue new research opportunities in promoting Acadian forest management, as well as different things like fire in the Acadian forest, which hasn't really been studied much in the past, which we now kind of have the opportunity to, as well as different business models surrounding non-timber forest products. So we actually have a guy who collects moss within the community forest. So seeing if there's any kind of impact on the ecosystem and where we can move from there to building a monetary model for collection of non-timber forest products on Crown land. Okay, well, that's it. Reach out to us. If you're looking for firewood, I'm your girl to call, sustainably harvested wood. And if you have any questions or are interested in membership, please shoot me an email and I'll give you more information.
Thank you, Mary Jane. Councilor Fisk, you have a question or comment?
Just a quick question. Very good presentation. I enjoyed it very much. You mentioned multiple use planning under, are you working with the ATV associations to come up with some solution? Does that include Queens and Shawburn and also Annapolis?
For what, AT?
For to go on trails? Roads?
Yes, so we mostly talk with ADVANCE is our main contact, Corey Robar, the trails coordinator with ADVANCE.
Yes.
We haven't yet really gone beyond the provincial authority to the local ATV groups, but it's on our agenda to do within the next year.
Can I ask this? You might not be able to answer. Why is it taking so long to go there?
I guess because I thought Corey would be the main contact. It's not that we're avoiding it by any means. We wanted to actually host maybe a poker rally or something in the community forest this year. It's very, very busy with the development of our crown forest operations, and we haven't really been able to touch recreation other than, I actually wrote the proposal for that small footpath in the protected area 2 weeks ago, so it's all coming together. It'll come under wraps kind of this summer.
So, you see movement coming for the ATVs in the near future?
Yeah, I'm kind of in regular conversation with Corey, as well as Harley Conrad, who's kind of more with the fish and game in Bridgewater, but those two people are kind of our active members and on our recreation committee, and we're working towards steps on how we can include that community more.
Well, the reason I say that is I know there's protected lands in through the land, but the ATV access to
Albany
the Pomar
New.
Lands?
Yeah. There's no longer
or
gates on the Albany New
Why
access.
Why not hearing that?
They removed the gates. They were open. They were opened in 2015, and they removed the gates this spring.
On both ends?
The Albany New End. On all of our lands, there's still the gate and in the Rosy Knoll district, but
that's where I'm coming from.
That's not on our land base anymore.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're just past the Queens County line, all in Annapolis County. Yeah.
Good presentation. Thank you.
Thanks.
Councilor Johnson?
Mary Jane, that's excellent. Every time we hear you guys come in from this perspective and the partnership with MTRI and working with, the more we can learn about this and understanding the different pieces, and I really like the part of where you're looking at different harvesting processes based on the community and getting DNR on side.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the biggest question I got for you is, what keeps you up at night, this process, and where can we as a region start working together? Because I know I've been on my to-do list to meet with Amanda as well.
Yeah.
And just how can we all kind of work together towards whatever common roadblocks are there for you?
Yeah, there's a bit of, I don't want to say broken trust is maybe a bit harsh, but there's definitely an aversion from government to completely give control to a community. They don't necessarily think the knowledge is there. But I mean, we have you probably know some of our directors on our board, we have a very diverse board. A lot of foresters on our board, ecologists, community advocates, etc. So that kind of trust in, yes, we can do partial harvests here. No, we don't always have to do clear cuts. That's where we're kind of coming up with these roadblocks. So moving beyond the traditional Crown forest management schemes and being able to do our own thing is kind of where what keeps me up.
Okay, well, that's good to know, because if we can help with that, then however we can lobby, I guess.
Yeah.
Our positions. Great, thank you.
Councilor Mews?
Instead of it in forest fire, how long before that land there can be used for regenerative forestry?
So actually, I just had a meeting yesterday with a man from Forest Recovery Canada, and they're interested in finding, like, they actually got community corporate donors from all over North America who want to plant trees, because planting trees is a very it thing right now. So they had a donor come in that wanted to plant a million trees. So of that, I told them I could probably fit in 20,000 on kind of the burnt cut over sites. So hopefully we'll be doing that either this fall or next fall. Yeah.
As a question, Mary King, natural regeneration is anticipated on that burnt land?
Not sure. We've seen a bit of kind of red maple, like what are undesirable species coming up at this point. The fire burned quite deep, and a lot of the organic matter that would otherwise bring soil nutrients back post-fire cut over top is also a very, very rocky land base. So natural regeneration is always the preferred method, but I think it would be a good opportunity to experiment with a bit of tree planting, incorporating species that are more, probably incorporating some climate change science with that, and species that are more drought tolerant, like red pine, red oak, white pine, birch, some of the species that would otherwise grow in like hotter, drier climates. Yeah.
Do you spray pesticides on your own?
No. No Crown plant-based spray pesticides. We're promoting species diversity, and I love hardwoods. We want to promote hardwoods as much as possible.
Any other council?
further on that, with the burnt wood, you said that with the burnt wood, of course, there's no market for it,
mm-hmm.
right? But there is, like, as I know, Karen's here today, with Brooklyn Power, couldn't that be used as a fuel?
Yeah, I think the general consensus on the board is that we think it would probably have a greater impact in bringing nutrients back to the site than if we remove. Like, there's not enough science around removing burnt wood post-fire and how that affects soil health. So there's a bit of aversion there towards taking out all the material. And the unfortunate thing is that we're not usually the first person that Brooklyn Power goes to, because we're a very, very small land manager, and that the biomass market in general is so small that we can't really get our foot in the door. Yeah, so we do, we don't quite have enough market for all of the firewood that we cut. We get a bit more will be purchased back through whoever is cutting the wood. A lot of the larger contractors actually sell their own firewood, so we'd like to be able to have an entire firewood supply, and I think we're well towards that. Digby, Conway Workshop in Digby actually takes up 500 cord a year, which is a significant amount. And more of those larger contracts are very lucrative for us, so we'd like to just create more of those.
Is that something that we could help you with as far as advertising for that? Or
I've been thinking about, I know there's Penny Lane in Liverpool, but I don't think they do larger firewood production.
No,
they do Kinley, but that might be something. If you know any firewood producers looking for firewood, that would be a good opportunity.
Any other councillors? Thank you, Mary Jean, for the presentation. Very interesting. Moving along on the agenda today, we are now at 4.0, tabling up petitions. Are there any petitions to be presented today? Second call for petitions. Third and final call. No petitions for today. We are now at 5.0, public comment question session. Any members of the public gallery, please state your name and address, please.
Leon Robertson, College Street, Liverpool. First of all, I'd just like to say the two presentations were very encouraging, very well put together, and it's good to hear under the first one that's going to be creating a number of jobs, a few in the beginning, but as it goes on, it could create a number of jobs there, and I would assume these would be paying jobs. That's good to hear. The second one, with the management of our forest and so on, it's good to hear that it's being looked at and worked on, because you see over the past number of years, these large contractors come in and they will clear cut hundreds of acres, and they're gone. The wood's gone, and there's very little revenue as far as the region is concerned. And it's good to see that we need to see it managed. And that group sounds like that they're doing a good job. Anyway, getting on to the item that I wanted to, under 9.2, your advocacy priorities. And the one there with respect to the renewal and replacement of Hillsview Acres, I spoke on this before, Mr. Mayor, and indicated that perhaps maybe we should be looking at building going for assisted living apartments with the nursing home component attached to it, and perhaps maybe what would happen. I know that it needs to be improvements and upgrading and so on with respect to the Queen's Manor, and as I've said to you before, maybe that could be looked at as a residential care facility, and maybe with a few nursing beds there, but also I mentioned about the land before, but now we're looking at that. That's been sold for commercial development over by Queen's Place, but there's land, as I understand, available, that could be made available near the Queen's Manor above there, far as the rest of them are concerned, they all sound good and in order. The only other thing that I mentioned before, too, with respect to the Charter Beach, and I know the province wants to come in there and have it protect the beach and so on, but I think it could, if it's done properly, we could have the best of both, and as I and some other people have suggested, is having the access down at Logan Camp Beach there, down by the Cranberry Hall, the famous Cranberry Hall, and public access is there, and if you put proper walkways to the beach from there, it shouldn't disturb the dunes too much. We have some of the beach. There's proper walkways and everything there. I don't see where that's being destroyed. It's been there for a number of years. I remember going there as a kid, and I go there now, and I don't see too much difference. And I think if we could establish both if we made some adjustments there. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you, Leon. This briefing document is intended to bring our new MLA-elect, Kim Maslin, up to speed on municipal issues, and certainly that discussion will no doubt increase to cover other items as you have outlined today. During the previous provincial election, meetings that were scheduled between the Region of Queens and provincial staff have slowed down and sometimes stopped, so we're hoping to get back into that mode where we can make progress on issues as we have identified and others. So we wanted to share with the public some of the items that we will be discussing at that meeting that's upcoming.
And I will be talking to her as well. I know her very well, and I will be bringing this point forward as well. I think the more people that do that, as far as taxpayers, I think it would all help in your efforts.
And I would expect that she would be well open to comments from the members of the Region of Queens to have that discussion. So thank you very much. Any other member of the gallery that would like to comment or question today? Yes.
I'm not going to comment on that, but
your
my name is Karen
address?
Cowie. I'm with the on 24 Old Falls Road. I'm here to talk today about the excessive traffic going up Old Falls Road that's going up extremely fast. I know that I just moved there in September. It's a 30 km/h access road. What most people are doing are bypassing the lights when they see that the light is red. They're coming up Old Falls Road extremely fast, and I'd like to see what we could do about slowing down that traffic. I'm not opposed to having people cut up that road because it's a public road and it's serviced by Region Queens, you know, with Wild and all that good stuff. But I have a problem with at least 60 km/h going up that road. I don't know how they make that corner, because it is a very sharp corner. I walk my dog, my child lives there. We have several families that have small children and animals that live on that street. Now, there is a posted speed limit at the top of the hill, which to me is too far away. I'd like to see that posted speed limit come down maybe as soon as you turn up that power access road there. I understand we can't put speed bumps there because of the DOT plowing and such, right? But if we could post some sign that indicates that maybe local traffic only, we can go up and out that road, but when you're coming down by the ambulance station, you can't come up. However, I have seen on occasion people doing that as well. So I'd like to see what we could do in the Region of Queens trying to help stop that excessive speed from going up that road.
I've made a notation on the location of the sign,
right,
and we'll see what we can do to have one placed at the beginning of the road. I have a question. Are your speeders 7 days a week or on particular days?
So on the weekend, just in particular, I was trimming my hedge both on the highway side and my road. There had been at least 25 people there going up that road on a Saturday when I was trimming that hedge, and 95% of those people do not live on that street, and they were going at least 40-50 km/h going up that street. So that's the weekend. I work during the day, so this is very hard for me to actually get here from the county. stop light is there by the old Elkmarin crossing to Irving. When we finally get the light to walk, we are, I'm not kidding, I actually videotaped it. It's about 5 seconds by the time that you get that light to turn the walk sign, and then it hits the flash for you to not walk. We're halfway out in the middle of that road, and we're getting honked at on several occasions to say, what are you doing out here? Either, I mean, I walk really fast, and I run. I can't make it across that street before that light turns to a stop sign, to a please don't cross. Right, so I just recently found out that hand means nobody from this end can cross, but I know that I didn't know that. I know that my daughter doesn't know that. I know that probably 3/4 of the people here didn't understand that that is what that stop sign actually means. So if you can maybe extend it so that person gets a chance. I mean, we have a lot of senior citizens trying to cross that street as well, going from there and going to the grocery store and Tim Hortons and such like. That's the only side that I use. I don't know about the other lights and how long the timer is for that, but it doesn't give you sufficient time to cross that street safely.
We'll pass that along to the traffic authority to review that.
Okay, I appreciate that. And you know, if there's anything I can do to help push that along, I'm definitely going to do that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other member of the gallery?
Kim Williams, Farr Street. I'd like to thank you for the crew for going out and improving the walkways going to Beach Meadows. That's much improved, and thank you. The other thing is, it's good that we're having the discussion on the 20th about the new development that's going in behind Farr's. I love the idea of expanding and making more housing in that for the community. However, maybe the fact that we're having the meeting to discuss having it put in and approving it should have maybe happened before they actually go ahead and do it, because they're already stripping the land already. So it seems like you're saying it's going through anyway, and you really don't have a say. It's perception that should really put the cart before the horse. So yeah, it maybe should have lined up a little bit better. The discussion maybe should have been moved a little bit earlier before they go up there and start stripping it, because I know probably a lot of people on our road have no idea what's going on, except for the fact that 7:30 in the morning you're wide awake and you're not doing anything because it's way too noisy in the neighborhood.
Well, I appreciate that. We'll have a chat with our works people and make sure that we cover more residences on that street. Any other member of the gallery?
Bill Cox, 191 Bar Road, Point Point. I have two items, if I may. Number one is in regard to the recent renaming of Elm Street to Waters Way. In the Agent Street naming bylaw, it says that consideration should be given to naming after veterans from the community who have made the supreme sacrifice or a significant contribution to our community. And there were a couple of names that were in those that were represented. I'm just wondering what the overriding consideration was in naming it after Walters as opposed to veterans in the naming of that street. And my second item is in regard to veterans parking. Bridgewater has recently made it possible for vehicles with veterans plates to park free where there is meter parking. And I'm just wondering if the region has given any consideration to a similar item in regard to guest parking within the community.
Thank you, Bill. I'll answer two questions in order. My memory of the bylaw regarding naming of streets, or the policy, whichever it would be, gives consideration to veterans, to those individuals who lived in the community in addition who have contributed in a positive manner. No exact criteria that requires one or the other of those classifications to be the chosen name. The names that were submitted were all presented to council. There was a majority nomination for the name by all councillors, and Welders Way was the one that received the successful name, and hence the reason for it being chosen. Not to lessen the impact and the benefits that veterans have provided, but they're just one of the criteria in that policy that would be considered. The other issue, when you asked about veterans parking, that is an issue that has surfaced, and I expect that within a month you'll see some discussion on that. Thank you very much.
Just as a follow-up on the first item, the concern was that while there was a submission to Voters Way, there were also submissions to names like Sydney Ford and so forth, and Sydney Ford was one of the leading pilots during the Second World War, and was part of the general community of Liverpool. He grew up there, and his family were there for many years, and it was felt that maybe council were unaware of the provision in that bylaw to name streets after veterans. When you consider in town we've named streets after Waterloo and different places in England, but we haven't named any streets within the confines of Liverpool or Caledonia, whether you have defined streets that has included the names of veterans, and from the Legion standpoint, we would like to see council starting to move in that direction. It sounds like we're going to have some additional streets around within the near future, and we just wanted council to be aware that we would appreciate a little more emphasis on that particular section of the street name bylaw.
And I thank you, Bill. It's very appreciated. Council was briefed on all the names and all the submission information that was contained, so I'm certain that we all have a very good understanding of Sydney Ford and a wonderful, proud member of the community who did his service on behalf of us all. So thank you for that. It's well appreciated. So we'll move on now to the next item, which is
Mayor Clark.
Yes. Councillor Fancy?
Sorry, I've done that before. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, Councillor Fancy.
Okay,
I'm quite forgiving.
a couple comments on what Kieran had put forward, because that's in my district. Just wanted to say, Old Falls Road has been an ongoing issue, not just in the recent times, but with our development of Queen's Place and with the concerts and even the more work coming down to the mill and things, there's more and more people taking that road up through. There's been issues even when they're going up over the top of the hill. They've gone so fast that they've actually elevated the wheels have come off the road, and they've hit both sides of the road, hit into the bushes and tore things up. So it's been an ongoing issue for a long time. People are trying to avoid the lights, and again looking at things even like saying maybe after 4:30 you can't go up the street, or doing something. We have to address it because somebody is going to get hurt up in that area. The other thing, the lights, I think it needs to be an information of some sort, because people don't understand, and I didn't understand either, is when people step out onto the road because it's green with the light, that when it turns red, that means nobody else can come. If you're out there and it's red, the traffic doesn't even understand that they're saying they're walking through a red light, but it's not a red light, because it means nobody else can come out on that street because they've already timed out. So maybe it needs a signage, something to both say what it is, and people will get more informed on what, because even seniors are trying to run across there because they think they're in the middle of a red light and they got to get out of there.
And there's likely a number of factors that need to be taken in consideration for a resolve to that issue.
Yeah.
But as you're well aware, the traffic authority is the one that deals with these issues, be
right.
It the timing, the delay, the type of light. So we will pass it on to the traffic authority for a review,
right.
Because we are within the region of Queens only able to pass it on to them for their expert analysis and recommendation, and we will do that, because because I agree with you. We need to have that street safer than what it is if we have people speeding on that street. There's no question. So we're ready to move on to the next item, 6.0.